Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Sports Yak.
Oh my heavens!
One host knows sports.
And who's right there?
The other doesn't know sports, but somehow they meet in the middle. Corey Mann.
Get your big butt out of here!
And Indiana Sports Broadcast Hall of Famer.
This one will be relived.
Chuck Freebie.
Forever!
Do you like sports? Because we like sports. Let's talk about sports. It's Sports Yak. Sports Yak. It's Sports Yak.
Live from a bunker in the heart of the Ozarks, a podcast that only drinks Diet Coke out of a can and through a straw, it's Sif Pop. Welcome to Sif Pop Weekly, streaming live most Saturday mornings or available to download later in your podcast feed, unless, of course, you're a patron.
Patrons get perks.
Patrons get those perks.
I thought you liked Betty Boop.
I'm your host, Aaron Dicer, and I'll preach and he'll sing. It's Andrew Ormsby, ladies and gentlemen.
You are my sunshine, my sunshine.
Each week we'll chat about movies, TV, and whatever else from the pop culture universe is on our minds. And please welcome our guest this week, dear Aaron Dicer. Today is going to be an amazing podcast, and here's why. It's Aaron Schweitzer!
Oh, that's very touching. Woo! Thank you.
Yeah, glad to have you back, man.
Glad to be back.
Aaron is one of the managing editors at sifpop.com and helps out with the site and puts stuff together, so you can see stuff from him there as well. And occasionally gets to jump on the show, and he said, hey, I have to come talk about Dear Evan Hansen. So we'll get into the reasons for that here in a little bit. We are going to talk Dear Evan Hansen. We'll also catch up on The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which was a recent release. So we'll talk a little bit about that one as well. Our best ever challenge this week is best ever mistaken identity movies. So movies where somebody's identity is mistaken, not purposely deceived, but mistaken identity movies. So we'll take a look at that. And of course, we got Buried Treasure and all those fun things as well. Everybody ready? Everybody doing good? All hearts clear?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Do we need to have like a session, you know, to talk about anything serious before we get into? I mean, you know, there's a lot of serious subject matter today. I just want to make sure everybody's good.
Man, my session is going to be finally talking about these two movies.
Yeah, there you go. That will be the session. Well, let's get it started. Let's chat a little bit about Dear Evan Hansen.
Have you ever felt like nobody was there?
No one signed your cast. Now we can both pretend we are friends.
I'm sorry about my brother.
Have you ever felt forgotten in the middle of nowhere?
I wish everything was different. Wish I was part of something. I wish that anything I said mattered.
Have you ever felt like you could disappear?
Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah, that's mine. I'll just take it.
Wait, I need that back.
Like you could fall and no one would hear.
Evan Hansen, a high schooler with social anxiety, unintentionally gets caught up in a lie after the family of a classmate who committed suicide mistakes one of Hansen's letters for their son's suicide note. It stars Ben Platt, who originated the role on Broadway, I believe. The music comes to us from Pasek and Paul, who you may know from La La Land, Greatest Showman, and a few other things. You've got Caitlin Dever in there, Amy Adams, Julianne Moore, some high-hitting talent. What did we think of Dear Evan Hansen? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay? Andrew, start us off.
Aaron, you tricked me into watching a musical. How dare you?
You didn't know, huh?
No, I didn't know. As soon as he started singing, I'm like, oh, no, here we go. No, I will go with low side of liked it.
Oh, very nice. Aaron Schweitzer, what do you got?
That just relieves so much pressure. I think I'm also on the low side. I liked it. Like, almost just okay.
Okay. Wow, I'm way below you guys. I severely didn't like this movie. I had a rough time with this movie. So I'll let you guys talk for a while about what you liked about it. Schweitzer, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, so everything that I say about this movie, you really have to take with not just like a grain, but like a giant pinch of like a really coarse kosher salt.
Like the entire pile of Lot's wife of salt. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, the musical just means so much to me and my wife, and so I was never gonna like hate this movie. But I have a lot of issues with the translation from the musical to the film. But ultimately, since we like to start on positives, it's really hard to deny that this is one of the best soundtracks ever written, at least from my point of view. The Broadway one's better, but I think that Pasek and Paul are the best
geniuses
in the industry.
I think they're geniuses. I really do. Yeah.
I will go next, and I want to shout out just the performances in this movie all around. I think that, you know, especially Ben Platt, I think that he's working on another level. I think the only thing I've seen him in besides this was the Pitch Perfect movies. Mm-hmm. So I should have known it was a musical going in. So that's on me, guys. I'm not gonna lie. But no, I think that he is great. He has a way of making the character that he is portraying. Besides everybody else, I think that his character has the most difficulty hiding, you know, his anxiety. You know, I think that there's other characters, especially Amandla. Well, Amandla Stenberg, her character, Alana Beck, you know, a lot of people, if they have like social anxiety or depression or something like that, you know, they're good at hiding it, you know, like, but Ben, his character of Evan definitely can't. And he does it in a way to where it's not a mockery of it, or he's not doing Rain Man. It's just one of those things where it's like he's bad at hiding his social anxiety, but it's not like there's more to his character than just that. There's definitely layers. Going off of what Schweitzer said, I think that the music in this is really good, but if you told me to tell you a specific song that I liked, I couldn't, because a lot of the songs sounded the same to me.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I think that could be a little bit of first time through kind of stuff too. You know, that's in general with musicals, you need to see them, hear them a few times before stuff, you know, even The Greatest Showman, which is another one of the greatest soundtracks of all time, as much as I don't like that movie, is that way. You know, the first time through, I would remember the songs and where they happened and kind of what they were about. But then as far as like singing along, that took like second, third listen, you know, to kind of feel that way about them. So, yeah, I can hear what you're saying there.
What about you?
I can say some positive things. Most of it does revolve around the music. I think that first song is one of the most incredible songs I've ever heard. Waving from the Window. I don't even know what the song is called, but yes, that's the one. Tap, 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 waving through the window. Is anybody waving back at me? Like, it's got so much pathos to it, so much emotion. It speaks to a real, kind of moment for this generation, for this upcoming generation, dealing with anxiety, who am I, those kind of things. I talk with friends often about the interesting dynamic between mental health issues in our children versus us. You know, like when we were growing up, there weren't as many definitions for it. There weren't as much, understanding of those kind of things. And so we talk often about, was it just undiagnosed? Was it just something that we all had, but we just didn't know? Are there things about this next generation that are creating more anxiety, more of, you know, these mental health issues that we talk about? So I think that is an interesting and worthwhile conversation to have in that first song, especially, and several of the others as well, really hit on it in such an interesting and powerful way that I just think it's undeniable how great the music overall is in this, but especially that first song. I really, really loved. I also think Caitlin Dever is amazing. I want to see her in everything. I think she's just an incredible actor. I've already spoken about, you know, Julianne Moore in the past, what an incredible actor she is. Amy Adams is great. I don't think she's necessarily great in this for some reason. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the direction, if it's the character or whatever, but I wasn't buying her as much as I was the others.
I agree. I think that we see too much of the denial in this character without seeing the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just how I interpreted it. Okay. Because it's just like, yeah, I see a mother who is denying, you know, what her son was or what he was, what his demons were, which, you know, in denial, I totally get that. But I think that the ratio of seeing a mom in pain of losing her son as opposed to a mom in denial of what was troubling him was very one-sided.
I will then move on to, Andrew, a big disagreement that I think we have, which is I think Ben Platt is a terrible casting choice for this. And I totally get why. He originated the role. I think it's not just his age. I know there's a lot of chatter about he's 28, he's playing 16, and I agree that doesn't quite work. I think he looks older than 28 in this movie a few times. I don't know why. I don't know what choices they made, but the impact, the distraction of that is not just that he looks older, it's that it turns some of the songs from like emotional to creepy. Like there's a song where it shows him like watching her and different, and it comes off as more like stalky and creepy than it does like giving me any kind of empathy for him or those kind of things. And I don't know that that's his fault. I don't know that I don't bring my own preconceived notions to that. I just know for me it was very distracting through the movie to try to buy into what he was doing. Now, I agree with you that he's super talented. I think it's undeniable. I don't think you can deny how incredible his voice is, especially in the singing and the upper register stuff that he does is just astonishing. But as far as acting goes, I was enough distracted by him being older and in it that I didn't really buy a lot of the tics and a lot of the... It almost felt overperformed to me. At times it fell into parody for me, satire. Like I just it felt almost like an SNL cast member trying to play a teenager at times. Again, I know I'm probably bringing a lot of that, you know, in myself, but it definitely impacted me. It definitely impacted me.
There's also like some weird like CGI de-aging choices in this movie. Like anytime it's close up on his face, they've essentially removed his upper lip. I was getting a lot of like Zack Snyder or Justice League Henry Cavill vibes to that. It was really weird, but. I totally agree with your point on it makes some of those moments creepy. I was telling Aaron that this musical means so much to me and my wife's journey in part because the song Only Us was the song that me and my wife danced to at our wedding reception. And in this, I'm almost embarrassed to say that from this movie because it came off as so creepy.
A lot of stalker vibes, right?
And like, it really changed the context of, which is a lot of this movie's issues are changes the context. And doesn't do it well.
So how's that come off in the musical then? That like, what are some of the specific choices? Because you're much more familiar with the musical than I think either of us are, like the stage musical. So what are some of those specific things?
I'll give three examples for the only us one. There's a lot more emphasis in the movie on talking about like. The relationship that they have with specifically the brother. And I feel like it's just a lot less downplayed. They're just like, hey, there's a lot going on around us right now, including the brother thing and just saying, you know, it could be us and only us and what came before doesn't count anymore. I think it's a standalone, an incredible song. And you put it in a context in the musical and it's just a little bit less like beat you over the head and remind you about the dead brother thing. than the movie does.
But does the how does the stage musical, and this kind of gets into my main major negative and why I really didn't like this, but how does the musical get away from just the terrible, terrible thing he is doing in that song? Yep. Like, I mean, just absolutely sociopathically terrible thing he is doing by using his own feelings about her and telling her it's her brother's stuff her brother said about her.
So those are two different songs.
Oh, okay. 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 I'm sorry. Maybe I misconfused.
The one you're referencing is If I Could Tell Her. It's a little bit more like an upbeat song.
I'm thinking about If I Could Tell Her. But yes, both of those songs had little issues with me, but yeah. Yeah.
The movie, here's the big, one of the big differences. And I think why a lot of people are giving this movie such terrible reviews is, first of all, Evan Hansen is not supposed to, he's your protagonist, but he's not supposed to be the guy you want to get away with anything in the end. He's not a really redeemable character. But one of the biggest differences between the musical and the movie, and I hate to just be that guy ad nauseum, but is,
I'm glad you're here to say these things. Absolutely.
Good. He does this, there's a lot more emphasis of him trying to get out of it at the very beginning and the parents not giving him that opportunity. Whereas in the movie, it feels like he just kind of clams up for runtime issues. Mm-hmm. He just kind of clams up and never gets a chance. But there's that moment where the parents come to the principal's office and tell him that Connor committed suicide and that they found the note in his pocket. And he tries to push back immediately. And they say, no, you're just in denial. He actually wrote these. You're just trying not to take the credit.
Yeah.
And they push him into this box and he tries to get out of it more like three or four times as opposed to not saying anything. So that completely changes your character motivation.
Absolutely. So in the stage musical, he is on board with this deception from the beginning.
It's one of those things that he still can't quite, the parents aren't willing to accept him saying, I didn't write this.
Mm-hmm.
And then even when he goes over to the house for dinner for the first time, and we have that For Forever song, he tries to tell them, you know, because they have the conversation with the friend and he's like, I've got to tell them that I didn't do this. So I've got to go to dinner and clear all this up. In the movie, he doesn't even make that attempt at that dinner scene. So when you omit his reluctance, his trying to get out of it at the very beginning, you change who this character is. And he's a straight up sociopath in the movie. Mm-hmm. And in the musical, he's more of a guy that just gets caught up in a really bad situation just kind of accidentally himself through some still really weird and still unforgivable stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting that you would see that distinction. I actually thought you were going the opposite way because I do see the movie trying to let him off the hook a little bit. Like I there are those moments where the movie is like, oh, he didn't want to do this, but he, you know, had to. But you're saying that's even more dramatic in like he's more trapped in the stage musical.
Yes.
Where here it feels like he's making conscious decisions to do these things. That's interesting.
And the other big distinction is towards the end. There is a character change in the movie that doesn't happen in the musical. And so I don't know if we're going to do a SIF spoil on this. So I don't know. This would be the only thing I would add there because I think it's important enough. I wouldn't.
Is there a way to talk around it?
There's a moment where Evan addresses the Instagram crowd.
Mm-hmm.
For the Connor Project.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen in the musical. And so the ending is very much a different ending, saying that everybody kind of embraces this.
Oh, that's a huge change.
Yes, that this was wrong and that I'm trying to bounce around spoilers. that the ending of the musical is a lot more just let this go. And everything will blow over and people will forget in 6 months, which is super pessimistic, but also accurate. The movie lets him off the hook at the end. And the musical does not. The musical lets him live in the agony of his choices, at least in the temporary. And the movie, I feel like, tries to just make this character redeemable and essentially gets off scot-free.
Wow. Okay. So that is a major change, and that does explain to me a few things, because I really had a hard time watching this movie and going, how was this a hit? Like this movie is so sociopath, like the main character that I think the movie is telling us we want to, you know, the best for, is just making such terrible, awful human choices. So yeah.
In the movie, he's a sociopath. In the stage play, he, like I say, he just kind of accidentally is himself and tries to get out of it at the beginning. But eventually, he does just like, look, I'm already in this. When, you know, when they give the emails.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll push back a little bit on the Caitlin Dever thing. I think she was an excellent choice, but she doesn't have the vocal range that role requires of her. Specifically in the Requiem song, which is where she's driving down the highway at 100 miles an hour. That last note that she's supposed to hit is supposed to be really powerful, like Idina Menzel type. And she gets maybe halfway there in the movie.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Other thoughts? Andrew, we haven't heard from you for a while. Some other Aaron, things.
Earlier you mentioned the fact that, you know, Evan Peters is like so much older. You know, he looks older than
Ben Platt.
Like, oh, wait. Evan is his. Yeah. He's, that's his character name. Yeah. Evan, isn't it? But that Ben Platt looks so much older than everybody else. I'm pushing back on that because while I was watching this movie, I was looking at this high school and it felt so much like a 90s teen drama.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Where they cast 30-year-olds.
Yes.
Because I'm looking around like, oh, so they got cast members with receding hairlines and bald spots and full beards and everything like that.
So you're just saying he fit in with the entire high school, that everybody there looked That's like it. They were in the yeah. mid-20s. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it was Caitlin Dever and Amanda who were the two that actually kind of looked closer to the age.
Well,
of what
Caitlin's mid-20s. It's not like Caitlin is a teenager. Caitlin Dever is in her mid-20s. Like, you know, so
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to talk about the runtime, because obviously this is based off of a musical. Musicals are always long. They're supposed to be long. You're paying hundreds of dollars for a ticket, so you got to get your money's worth.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe this is just my cynicism whenever it comes to musicals in general, but this was just too long. This movie was way, way, way too long. It felt like every single time there could have been a real moment, and I think that I'm just going to broaden this to the what I think are the tropes and cliches of musicals, and it's the fact that whenever I think that there is a moment that really deserves a real human, you know, emotion or a cathartic moment, it's ruined because they try and use music as the scapegoat, as a way to get out of, you know, having to show like how a person really would go through something, like the a conversation that he has with the family, the big conversation he has with the family, it's intertwined with them asking questions like normally and then him answering melodically, and it just feels like such a scapegoat and something that it, a way that I think just ruins what could a human moment by this Elseworld type of storytelling.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think that's just my cynicism and my dislike of musicals, but
well, there are different types of musicals, and this is one where the singing is integrated into the conversational plot. This isn't yeah. one of those musicals where the songs step away from the plot, say something, and then go back to the you know, plot.
Yeah.
This is integrated conversational musical. And if you're going to do that, you have to know that is more of a suspension of disbelief than the other, right? Like, 'cause you can imagine in the other that this is some sort of fantasy they're thinking or, you know, whatever. Here, you have to imagine they're not hearing him sing, or they are hearing him sing. And if they are hearing him sing, why aren't they reacting like, why are you singing? Yeah. So they obviously aren't hearing him sing, but we're hearing him sing.
Continuity,
but they're responding. Yeah,
movie.
So
and, continuity.
And with the shift in from dialogue to music, there's also a complete change in tone, because this movie mm-hmm. wants to
yes.
have the darkest darks and the brightest brights. And it doesn't balance them well at all. I didn't think so.
No, and that is my main negative, and I'll just go ahead and say it this way. Much like The Greatest Showman, in fact, much of my review of this is very similar to my thoughts on The Greatest Showman. I don't think this movie is willing to explore its subject matter in a meaningful way. And a lot of that has to do with the music, but a lot of it just has to do with the structure and the plotting. Anytime, Andrew, I think you were touching on this, but anytime something is serious, the movie wants to go music mode. And yeah. In doing so, it makes fantastical what is very real and traumatic. And that that is a very difficult thing to balance, and I don't think the movie does it very well. Because at the end of the day, what is this movie saying about mental health? What is this movie saying about suicide? Like, the answers to those questions can be found, but the way the movie goes about it makes it feel like a bedtime story rather than an actual in-depth conversation about trauma, mental health. I mean, you look at the main character in the movie, it could be Connor, right? Like, Connor could be and probably should be our focal point. And we hear him, we hear the real him very little in this movie. Much of what we see of him is other people's projections of who he is. And maybe the movie could say something interesting about that. But the movie doesn't feel to me like it's wanting to say anything difficult or traumatic. It's just wanting to say, hey, all this stuff exists. Emotions are real. Emotions are powerful. Listen to these incredible songs about how powerful emotions are in trauma. And it's like, yeah, but are we really exploring it? Are we really finding something at the end of the movie where we go, oh, man, that meant something to me in that way? And I didn't find it. That doesn't mean it's not there for someone. It just means I didn't find it, and I didn't have that experience with this movie.
No, you hit the nail on the head, because it is one of those things, and it was what I was kind of hoping to see in this movie. It's like, yeah, a lot of people are like curious, how do I have this conversation with somebody? How do I have this conversation with a loved one, a friend, or something like that? But whenever the person or the individuals just dive into song, that destroys any ability for them to get, yeah, okay, but how? I can't do that. I can't do that naturally or take anything away from that, because it's not pure. It's not real. And yeah, if you're going to have music in a movie like that, or in a Broadway show like this, don't make every single subject matter a musical number. You have to have those real moments, and you have to have those serious real moments that are true. You have to have moments where there is no music, where you see characters being 100% human, having those real conversations. Mm-hmm. Because if they did that, then this movie would have been elevated so much higher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, just like in the Greatest Showman, where the movie just seems unwilling to really think about exploitation, about the idea of, you know, selling tickets for people who look different or, you know, sound different, or like, it just wants everything to be, you know, a celebration of showmanship as opposed to actually exploring things. And this movie, I think, shortchanges its subject matter in much the same way. I don't think that's Pasek and Paul's fault necessarily, but
they keep doing it.
But they do keep doing it. But you know, maybe La La Land is their sweet spot, right? Like, where the subject matter isn't so, like, romance is important, relationships are important. Grappling with the idea of being able to move on from a really important relationship is important, but it's not so deep and traumatic that, you know, the music in La La Land feels like it's shortchanging its subject matter. So maybe they just need to write, you know, human stories that are kind of on that mid-level, as opposed to really trying to go for the deep stuff. I don't know. That's armchair quarterbacking. That's, you know, I can't write songs like that. So, you know, I don't know that I should have a say, but it's, you know, it's just the last two movies that I've seen their stuff in, I've had the same thought, is that the music doesn't do service to the actual subject matter. So, yeah.
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 Speaking of the music, there are three songs omitted from the original soundtrack, and there are two new ones. So Alana's song, the anonymous ones, is new, and Connor's song at the end is new. And they omit three songs that are all about the parents. And so by omitting those songs, really made all those characters feel, all the parent characters feel like one-dimensional cardboard cutouts to me.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely agree. Amy Adams, her problem, I think she was a great cast for the role, but she gave it 110%. And there was a lot of moments where she needed to give it like 40%. Like a lot more subdued, a little less like manic, crazy, all that. Mm-hmm. And so the songs, one of the songs that is omitted is the Julianne Moore character kind of after she's invited for the house party and they offer the scholarship and all that. And she just like breaks down is her, fighting and really just ripping into Evan and saying, you know, this is awful. Look what you've put yourself in. And like, you know, the song is called Good For You. And so she just says like, so you got what you've always wanted, like good for you. And look how you've hurt everybody around you and look at the mess you've got yourself in. So the omission of those three songs really made all the parent characters feel like afterthoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have much else to say. Do either of you guys have anything else to mention?
No post-courtesy.
No, not a one. Not a one.
No, I think I'm good. I think I've said my piece.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you go. That's Dear Evan Hansen. It is in theaters. Let's move on to The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
It's all part of our mission to help people. Anyone who's hurting or they feel like they've been left out, God has a plan for us.
What'd he tell you to do this time?
Jesus keeps a taking me higher and higher.
Jim will preach and I'll sing.
Higher and higher.
God does not want us to be poor.
Wonderful, a pleasure.
Now God has a voice in this fight.
Who's he fighting?
Liberal agenda, homosexual agenda.
Faith isn't political.
You can't talk to him like that. Jerry Falwell is a powerful man, Tammy Faye.
In the 1970s and 80s, Tammy Faye and Jim Baker rose from humble beginnings to create the world's largest religious broadcasting network and a theme park, and were revered for their message of love, acceptance, and prosperity. The Eyes of Tammy Faye stars Jessica Chastain as Tammy Faye and Andrew Garfield as Jim Baker. You've got Vincent D'Onofrio in there as Jerry Falwell. Cherry Jones plays Tammy Faye's mom in this. So some names you might know. What did you guys think? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay? Schweitzer, why don't you start us off?
Brayton liked it.
Right. Dead center liked it.
Dead center of liked it,
yeah. Okay. All right. Andrew, what about you?
This is one of those movies where it's difficult because there's so many high moments that I could bring up, but there are also so many low moments. So just keep that in mind when I say this is high side of didn't like it.
Okay. And when you say high side of didn't like it, you mean heading into it's just okay almost.
Heading into just okay.
Yeah. Guys, I am bordering on loved it. I really, really liked this movie. I don't think there's enough wrong with it for me that I don't think I'm going to put it into loved it. But man, am I glad I watched this. I had a lot of things about this that I really love. First of all, I'll just start here. Give Chastain all the stuff. Give her all the awards. Throw them all her way.
Congrats on your Oscar. Yeah.
Like it is that kind of performance you walk away from going, yes, congratulations on your multiple awards this award season. She's incredible in this. Absolutely transformative stuff. Astonishing stuff.
Literally.
And the kind of performance that that just like if you want to know how to make Aaron Dicer leave a movie just being in awe. This is the kind of performance that does that. It's, you know, it's Christian Bale as Dick Cheney. It's, you know, just the kind of performance that you walk out of and you just go, that person pulled a full master of disguise and became another person. Like that is just incredible stuff from Chastain here. So incredible, in fact, that I think she raises the bar too high for Andrew Garfield.
Yeah. Like, he's really good.
He's great, but compared to her, it's just like, it's just kind of one of those things. I felt unfortunate. I was like, how do you, you know, I think he's great as Jim Baker. I think it's, you know, it's wonderful, but she is just so transformative that, and through every season of Tammy Faye's life, like I believed every single age that she played in this. It was, amazing stuff. Yeah.
Andrew Garfield's great, but he's not in the Oscar conversation, I don't think.
I don't think so either,
But I think Vincent D'Onofrio is for supporting actor. I think he's incredible in this movie, too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I think he's really, really good. Yeah, so I would start there with the performance, and just knowing, A, we had a major transformative performance, and B, it's a biopic, you know that I'm already, like, hooked in. You know what I mean? Like,
those are your food groups.
Got me, right? Like, they've got me. So right there. You add in the third thing of dealing with people of faith, wrestling with their faith and trying to figure out, you know, what that means to them and what that is. And it's like, how was I not going to fall in love with this project? I think that this movie explores the idea of televangelism, the idea of prosperity-based Christianity, the idea of God doesn't want us to be poor. And so, you know, people manipulating other people to give them their money so that they can build big houses and theme parks and whatever. I think this movie does both things really well. The two things being, it does not let them off the hook for their choices, for their manipulation, for their misunderstanding of the faith, and at the same time makes them human and does not create them as just paint-by-number villains, especially for Tammy and Jim in this movie. Jim is a little more you know, cookie cutter villain, but definitely this movie is clearly about Tammy, and it allows Tammy Faye to be a fully formed human being with flaws and things that we like about her, and it doesn't feel like a caricature to me. It feels like a real person, and I didn't know if this movie was going to be able to do that, and it did it for me, and so that, again, is why I land in many ways so high on the film. I've talked a lot. I want to hear more of your guys' thought. Andrew, what about you? What are some of your thoughts?
I'm jumping straight into a negative here just to
counter
argument for what you said. So I don't know if it's just my disdain for televangelism, because whenever I think of televangelism, I automatically go to the exploitation, give us your money, sure, you know,
as you should,
super duper rich. But it's also the fact that I don't think that these characters really had their, I'm just going to call it a come to Jesus moment. You know, I don't think that they had that moment where, you know, you learn your lesson, you understand, you know, your faults, because I don't see that character progression. I see characters get their comeuppance, but as a learning moral moment in a movie, I don't think I see this from either Jessica Chastain or Andrew Garfield. Also, we need to give props to the makeup and prosthetics department, because they definitely help with the transformation.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I think that where I think this movie, this could just be picky. The movie I think this should have been was Tammy Faye's defiance in going against what this group of televangelism and the church in general, especially at the time, and their views on homosexuality. Mm-hmm. I think that they really, really, really missed a great opportunity to show this moment of Tammy Faye, because I don't know if you guys have seen the, this is based off of a documentary actually that RuPaul did. And, you know, it was one of those things where they really highlighted all the things that Tammy did for the, homosexual community and stuff like that. Like they kind of tiptoe and like they kind of dip their toe in it in this movie, but I'm like, man, you really missed out on what could be like the redeeming character moment for Tammy Faye. You know, they focused so much. I'd say 98% of this movie is all about televangelism, and I'm like, well, you really missed what this movie could and should have been about.
Man, I don't know that I agree with that fully. I understand where you're coming from, but I think this movie was very much about Tammy Faye loving people. I think those are the themes from the beginning to the end, is the idea that she never lost sight of this idea of what her faith was about, was acceptance, because she felt the shame and the outcast thing from such an early age that she wasn't invited into church because she was had out of wedlock or whatever, you know, the case might be, that she never lost her compassion for every single other human being and loving them. Even at the close to the end, we get a moment where she goes and has a conversation with some teenage boys. And the whole point of that scene is to go, doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter if you're making fun of her to her face, she's going to treat you as a human being with respect and love you and want to find a way to build a bridge with you. The movie also includes the very powerful AIDS interview that she did, mm-hmm. And some other things, which you weren't saying it didn't. I know you said like that there were some things in there. But I think it didn't want to be just about her love of the homosexual community. It wanted to be about her love of humanity and love of everybody. So I think that's the choice the movie made. And I appreciate that choice, because so much of the conversations and the arguments and the difficulties with people of faith engaging in culture have to do with these ideas of rules and, you know, this is how I see right and wrong. And if you're wrong, then I'm judging you. And so you don't belong. And so, you know, you're not part of us. And it's a very human thing. It's not just faith that does this, by the way. You know, it's humans in general have this thing where we judge each other and consider each other others. And I loved that this movie was like at the heart of this person who got caught up in all these things and is not blameless either. I don't think the movie makes her blameless for a lot of this stuff that she gets caught up in. At the heart of her, though, was the true idea of love your neighbor as yourself. And I think the movie does a really good job at portraying that part of who she is, and including the appeals to the homosexual community in that.
Yeah, but there's just that element of people doing biopics of a person, and you go through their entire life, mm-hmm. you know. There's so much more to the person than this televangelistic lifestyle. Yeah. Like, it barely touches on her work for the homosexual community. It barely touches on her being a mother. It barely touches on her being, it does touch on her being a daughter, you know, mm-hmm.
very
a little
much so.
Bit.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, I was watching this movie. I'm like, yeah, but there's so much more to this character than what I'm being shown. Sure. And I know that there's more to this character. I think even if you don't know who Tammy Faye is, watching this movie, you're like, she is more than what this movie is showing me her to be. And if this is a biopic of her life, you know, from very, very young age throughout, you're like, okay, this is a one-sided story. And it seems like it's the televangelistic community going, yeah, they made their mistakes, but hey, look at all the good they did. You know, they raised money. I'm like, yeah, but I don't want to see the televangelistic. I don't want to see the character that Tammy Faye is constantly putting on, you know, for the cameras and stuff like that. I want to know who the real Tammy Faye is. And I get a few moments of that, especially whenever there's antagonistic moments between her and Andrew Garfield, you know. But for the I think that too much of this movie is the TV persona.
Sure, sure. It sounds like you want like a 6-episode docuseries, you know, like, you know, I don't know how you do that in, you know, a movie and keep it under 3 hours to really explore it.
I'm becoming a bigger fan of whenever you do a biopic. Don't do somebody's entire life. Pick a specific moment in their life.
I agree with that.
And, you know, because if you dial in on that, you can really show who a person is throughout a course of days or weeks or months, you know, because you're getting way more personal instead of a broad generic brushstroke of who this person was.
Schweitzer, talk to us, man. What are some of your thoughts?
You guys are saying all the things I'm thinking of. I am 100% in the boat of this probably should be a documentary, or not a documentary, a miniseries with the way it's presented, because it tries to hit on so much, and so there are times that everything feels short-shrifted. And not only that, it tries to hit on every possible aspect of her life. I mean, there's drug addiction, and it's only like 5 minutes of the movie, and
right,
it's just forgotten about.
Right.
Now, it's because I think the movie portrays it as accidental, and then, you know, her.
It has a moment of resolution, but you're right. It's very cheap. You know, there is a moment where, you know, somebody says you need to stop doing that, and she's like, oh, I didn't even know that, you know, my doctors told me to. So it, but you're right. It's barely there. Yeah.
So they want to touch on so much, but there's also a lot of things that they just kind of omit, a lot of things that they do touch on don't get enough time. And like, that's, gosh, I hate to be the guy that's just like, oh, the stuff that this is based off of is all different. Because the woman that Jim Baker has an affair with was not just a casual sexual encounter, but he was accused of raping that girl. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
And they gloss over that in the movie. They just say that he had an affair, and it's like, that's totally different things. And then Tammy Faye winds up, actually her second husband is the guy that they pitched the water park to.
Mm-hmm.
And then he helps put them in, you know, ruin their organization and put Jim in prison, all that. So there's a lot of issues I have with that. It feels like they're trying to say so much. And I agree with Andrew. Take one part of Tammy Faye's life and just let it be there. If you want to have a little bit of backstory, and I think the perfect framing device for this movie would be around the AIDS conversation, that big interview, and to let that be the moment, because that's kind of the start of the collapse of the final collapse of what's been going on. And you can build tensions around, you can have people like back in the studio also kind of having these conversations while Tammy's on air. I think that's the better way to frame this movie. But the way that it is now, it just needs to be either a 3-hour epic, or it needs to be a 6-part document or 6-part biopic series. Yeah. And
my complaint. I still don't think this movie can do what you guys want it to do as a movie. I think it has to be a docuseries, because I think what they did for me and why it worked for me is I do think they focus on one part of her life. It's just not an event. I really do think there's a through line in this movie about how she loves people. I think that is the entire, I think that's the entire point of this movie, is Tammy Faye never stopped loving the outsiders. Like, that, to me, that's what this movie is choosing to focus on, and that's why I was compelled by it. All the stuff that's rotating around her like a hurricane, the drug addiction, the affairs, the Jim Baker stuff, the stuff we've mentioned, that is the hurricane around what we're supposed to see as somebody who is not blameless, but is caught up in this, you know, craziness, when all she wants to do is love people. That's been her whole life's goal, is to tell people that they're loved. And that's why it works for me, because I feel like that stuff, though it's not all fleshed out and touched on, it just adds to the cacophony of the different things that were around this woman throughout her life. I found the closure of this movie to be very interesting, and I want to have more conversations about it. I don't think it's not spoilery, I don't think, because again, we're dealing with, you know, real life events. So, but if you don't want to know how this movie ends, then I guess you can fast forward a little bit, but I don't find it spoilery for the most part. But it ends with her getting back into singing and doing a concert, I think at Oral Roberts, maybe. And the choice is made to cross-cut between the actuality of her just singing to a track to these people and to this like big production number idea. And I think the idea we're supposed to get here from this final scene is that she, along with her wanting to love everybody, is this idea that she always wanted to be a big performer. And I think that, to end it in that way, to me, is very interesting, because it brings up to me the negative aspects of this person in a way to say, we are redeeming her in some ways because we are showing how she loves people, but don't forget that this is part of the problem. Part of the problem is the performative nature of Tammy Faye, the performative nature of Faith. When you make Faith performative, bad things happen. And they drop a big American flag in that scene. And I can't, I am saying that the end of this movie is definitely making a point about love her for how she loved people, but understand this is the problem. And that you know, the idea of tying Christianity or faith in general to nationalism, to these kind of things, is why in many ways the world looks the way it looks like today. And for the movie to do that, I found conflicting. And I think that's the point. I think I'm supposed to leave going, ugh, I love, you know, this person, but this, you know, this is the problem, that she's caught up in this whole system that just puts people in that position. I don't know.
What you're hitting on right now is one of my favorite things about this movie, was that ending really stuck with me, because I was really confused as it was happening. But as I was thinking about it more, I was getting the same vibes. And I went off on the Writer's Room podcast on this movie, essentially saying, I don't think this is the movie we need right now. And now, having seen it, I mean, that was before the movie came out.
Okay.
Now, having seen it, I think this is exactly the movie we need right now. It's really interesting because of exactly what you're saying, because I thought this was going to just cause further divide and sour people's images of Christians, of just anything. And I think that division is the least thing we need in society right now. And that ending really brought it up to like you said, to say this is the problem, is because of the nature of this person. And you're right, Andrew, I don't think this movie has a come to Jesus moment. I don't think, you're right, these characters get their comeuppance, but I don't necessarily see repentance from these characters, or I don't see them.
Well, and the movie makes clear they don't see repentance from these characters in real life.
Yes.
Like, the movie in its, you know, post text, you know, pretty much says everybody's still doing the same thing. You know, so right. Yeah.
So, yeah. But I think that American flag drop was the moment where I was like, oh, that's what this whole last little bit is about. And I was just like, oh, that's, so symbolic of where we are as a country right now, and where the problems lie in this country right now. So,
yeah,
I thought that was great. Yeah.
Really did not like the ending of this movie.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. I really didn't. Because it exacerbated all of my problems with the movie at whole. Like, for me, I'm watching this movie and I'm like, I don't think that these, like, there are huge moments in this movie where I'm like, yeah, I don't think that they believe the things they're saying. Like, truly believe, like, the, especially, I'm talking about, like, the praise be, you know, and Jesus loves me, this I know, you know. It sounds like they're just, I know that I don't want to paint the brush that I'm saying that they're not Christians and that they're doing this solely to exploit for money, you know. Mm-hmm. But there is definitely a level of, I am going to exploit my faith for fame and wealth, you know. And I, whenever I'm watching the end of this movie, I'm just hit with, so you learned nothing.
I think that's the point.
Nothing. I know, but the ending of this movie is, it seems like a championing moment. And it's like, it doesn't, I get the assumption that you guys walked away from this movie in the ending going like, yeah, she loves people. She got her comeuppance and now she can, and it's sad, but here we're going to show that this is a sad person who didn't learn their lesson and that they're stuck in this lifestyle and that they're stuck in this mindset and we're supposed to feel bad for her in this moment. But whenever I'm watching the ending of this movie, I'm like, I think that the movie is like championing her right now. And I felt, that's where I just felt icky. I'm like, no, I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. This is not what I was hoping this movie would end up saying or doing.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I enjoy movies that can make us have these conversations. And so that's, you know, probably another reason that I, you know, come away from it liking it so much. But I can see that, Andrew. I can definitely see that. I think Schweitzer and I are saying similar things. It made us feel icky too. And I do think that is the I don't mean to speak for you, Aaron, but I know we kind of saw it in similar ways. But yeah, I definitely felt icky watching that. And I think that is the intent. And I wonder if I haven't seen the documentary it's based on. It sounds like you have, Andrew. Is that correct?
Bits and pieces of
okay,
it. Yeah.
Okay.
I tried to watch all of it, you know, before today, mm-hmm. but I just didn't get to finish it. So.
It sounds like that documentary comes away with a pretty positive view on Tammy Faye, right? Like that it's presenting something positive about her. I could be wrong. Again, I've never seen it.
No, it highlights the good she did for, you know.
And I just don't think
homosexual.
I just don't think this movie was interested in making her a hero. I think it was interested in making her a human. And so, like, to do that, they have to walk a really fine balance of, we want you to love this person, but we don't want to acquit her for her past or existing complicit in these things. So, it's a hard thing to do. I thought the movie did it well. You know, you didn't. That's okay. Like, we have different experiences, but yeah. So, anyhow,
how interesting that both of these movies that we're talking about today elicit such controversial, you know, and wavering ideals of like what the movie wants us to think about the mm-hmm. main characters.
Sure, yeah. What were you going to say, Schweitzer?
I'm really interested in checking out the documentary after seeing this. At this point, more than I am in a rewatch of this movie, but. I am definitely not opposed to wanting to check this one out again. I'm just like very interested right now in seeing the Eyes of Tammy Faye documentary.
Yeah. I guess my one last thing, the other thing I would say, just because you brought it up, Andrew, I think it's an important thing when dealing with questioning what people believe versus what they're doing to manipulate people. It is incredible to me the things the human mind can rationalize and truly convince itself it believes. It is very possible that somebody is sociopathic enough to not believe what they're saying and to manipulate people. I believe that probably happens in many cases. It is also very, very possible that they have convinced themselves of a truth that they can't see how hurtful and false it is. I think both cases are possible, both cases are true, and both cases happen. We have this incredible capacity to convince ourselves of things that, you know, internally we believe to be true, and externally people are going, you really believe that? Like, so it's human nature is complex. But I've definitely seen it happen in myself, in others. It's part of being human, is this ability to rationalize in many things. So
yep,
there you go. All right, before we head on to the best ever challenge, I do want to say thank you to our SIFPOP members. We had a great conversation on the Emmy Awards for the bonus podcast this week. If you're interested in checking out the SIFPOP membership, it is at patreon.com/SIFPOP. It keeps this podcast going, keeps the website going. Really appreciate you guys doing that. Again, you can check that out at patreon.com/SIFPOP. Lots of fun stuff that we do there. And you can check out all the different levels. Support starts at $3 every month. If you love what goes on here and it would not be hurtful to your finances in any way to do so, we thank you for that support. patreon.com/SIFPOP. All right, let's move on to the best ever challenge. Best ever mistaken identity movies. There is an article on SIFPOP of this best ever challenge if you want to check out some of our writers' choices for this. But we'll go from number 5 to number 1. Feel free to trump any choices that you have higher so that the person who has it the highest can talk about it first. We'll start at number 5. Schweitzer, why don't you kick us off? What's your number 5 mistaken identity movie?
This is where I have Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Good choice. Had it in my honorable mentions.
Good show. Yeah.
Cool. I just figured that one would get trumped. I do prefer Holy Grail to Life of Brian in terms of the Monty Python ones, but it's hard to deny that this is one of the funniest movies ever made and has some of the most iconic moments ever in film. Thinking of the Biggest Dickus scene and the one with correcting the Greek grammar for the vandalism, mm-hmm. the people.
Oh, yeah.
which is maybe my favorite scene in the movie. Lots of good thematic stuff here as well. And in a lot of ways, some of the same things that we're talking about, for Dear Evan Hansen and Tammy Faye. Yeah, this is where I had Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Nice.
Quiet, you silly person.
No, it's a good choice. It's a good choice. And, you know, everybody knows Holy Grail, and a lot less people know some of the other Python movies. And Life of Brian is an interesting one to check out. My number five is Game Night. Got it trumped. There you go. Guess we're on to your number five,
Andrew. It was an honorable mention. I'm going to go with Lucky Number 11. I love talking about this movie, apparently.
So we can talk about it.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, go for it.
And Andrew, I also love this movie. Aaron, it really is worth a second shot. I know you mentioned it last time we brought it up. This is one of those really interesting, like, interwoven plots, and definitely among the best of them, for sure.
Nice.
Yeah. Everybody's on their A game. I love the set design, everything. It's just a great, great movie.
Lucky Number 11 in at Lucky Number 4 for Schweitzer and 5 for Ormsby. All right, on to my number 4 then. This is where I had Back to the Future.
Trump.
Man, Schweitzer, you don't have any Trumps left.
I have one more. And I think I'm going to have to use it.
Andrew, what is your number 4?
The Big Lebowski.
Oh, it's not Trump.
I was waiting. Yeah. This is, I think, the most famous mistaken identity movie out there, you know? That's literally the entire plot of this movie. I love the Coen brothers. We're going to be talking about them later on in the show. Mm-hmm. But I love the Coen brothers. I mean, they get me. Their style of comedy, their ridiculousness, it's brilliant. And I think that the Big Lebowski, obviously, this is Jeff Bridges' best performance. It's John Goodman's best performance. I love this journey that this incredibly lethargic man goes on. For as lazy and like just chill as this guy is, he goes on one of like the grandest adventures. It's just brilliant. I love it. He just wants to go bowling, man.
He just wants to go bowling.
And I worked in a bowling alley whenever I first saw this movie. So
that's fun. Yeah. I had it in my honorable mentions. Certainly worth mentioning. As a mistaken identity movie. All right, on to our number threes. Schweitzer, what do you got?
Yeah, this is where I have Game Night.
Okay, I had it at number 5. You got it at number 3. Talk on it.
This is one of the best comedies of the last 10 years.
The
performances are perfectly cast. I think it's a really clever movie as well. Jesse Plemons being a standout, for sure.
Easy.
There's enough about this that works both as a like non-comedy mystery and enough funny moments that really kind of balance both of them well to give one of the best all-around movies. This came out when MoviePass was a thing. You guys remember MoviePass?
I do remember MoviePass.
I saw this like three times in the theater and I really loved it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's why I had it at number 5. I think it has been said many times, it deserves saying again, it is so much more than a comedy. There's so much care put into the production choices made in this movie and just how well it's structured. And man, it's just clever. It's funny. Great performances. Hard to overstate how much fun Game Night is. I've seen it.
And
it has
Aaron's favorite comedic line of the last decade.
It does.
Oh, no, he died.
It has one of my favorite lines, but I can't say it on the show.
So. There's that as well. So Game Night in at your number 3. So I think that's my number 3 is next. Galaxy Quest I had in it.
It was my very first honorable mention.
Yeah. Man, do I love this movie.
So good. It's brilliant.
It really is. And before we were awash in comedic Star Trek type stuff, you know, now we've got the Orville and Lower Decks and, you know, this was kind of the first to kind of poke that comedy element of a sci-fi show like Star Trek, or the fandom of a show like that.
In a meta way.
In such a meta way, in such an interesting way. And man, I love the performances here. I love the jokes. Just incredible casting all around. From Tim Allen to Alan Rickman to Sigourney Weaver. Just really great stuff. So yeah, had to mention Galaxy Quest.
You can't forget, whenever you're talking about Galaxy Quest, you can't forget to talk about Sam Rockwell as
Guy.
Oh,
yeah. Is there air?
Yeah.
You don't know?
No. I also love Tony Shalhoub's, like, just, hey, ship's breaking apart and all. Mm-hmm. Just FYI. Yeah.
So good.
Oh.
So yeah, good.
It's such a I think I'm gonna watch Galaxy Quest again today.
Never a bad choice.
Because it's such a rewatchable movie. You could watch this movie 1,000 times and it would never get old.
Yeah.
It's great.
No.
Is
I don't
there
disagree.
Air you don't know.
You don't know? All right, what do you got at number 3, Andrew?
My number 3 is, if my list will pull up. Thanks, phone. Prisoners.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think of this
because
one.
Because if you really think about it, the Paul Dano character is really, and it's, I'm going to try and talk around this without spoilers, but there is a possibility of a mistaken identity with this character, because you don't know going into this whether or not he is the killer or not.
Mm-hmm.
But Hugh Jackman is so, I think, without Hugh Jackman's character being so adamant about Paul Dano being the killer, that his mistaken identity and like mistaken conviction,
mm-hmm.
Conviction in the sense of, you know, being convicted of a crime and being accused, mm-hmm. his mistaken accusation, I guess is a better way to say it, is really the driving force of the whole movie. So I think that that's, I might be pushing the boundaries of what mistaken identity means in some mm-hmm. ways, but, you know me, I love this movie so much, I had to find a way to put it
in
there.
Sure, yeah, totally get it.
Yeah.
All right, on to our number 2s. What do you got?
Yes.
Yeah, this is where I have Soul.
Yeah, me too. So we can talk about it at the same time. Go for it.
Cool. I don't like this movie as much as you do, Aaron, but I don't know what anybody does. I think it's good. I think it's really good. Great. I love it. I think it's gotten better the more I've watched it. But it's such a heartwarming movie that has a lot to say. I think it's Pixar's first movie for adults,
mm-hmm.
More than it is for kids. And I think, obviously, the animation's incredible. There's really not much to not love about this movie.
Yeah. For some people, it's the ending. But I really dig the ending. I really think that's the best way to finish that movie. But man, there's so much to love about Soul. I've talked about it plenty. I don't have to rehash everything, but if nothing else, the music in this movie is just astonishing. I could listen to this soundtrack all day, every day. It's so good. And it's beautiful. It's a really beautiful movie. So yeah, love Soul. That's my number 2. And Schweitzer's number 2. So what about you, Andrew? What's your number 2?
Everybody's favorite female name in the title of a movie. I'm going to go with Saving Private
Ryan.
That's right. Yeah.
This would have been on my list, but we specified for the website saying it had to be plot relevant and decided it wasn't.
Yeah.
But that note was not the email.
You
so
tell Mason Fillion if it was plot relevant or not. The man went on a journey over those 5 minutes.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to complain.
I think the plot relevance of it is the whole finding a needle in a stack of needles, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You thought I pushed the envelope with Prisoners. I'm really pushing it with Saving Private Ryan.
Listen, I'm never going to...
This is a mistaken identity.
Yeah, I'm never going to discount Saving Private Ryan from a best ever challenge. I have no right to. So.
Wouldn't that be ironic if you did? Wouldn't that be ironic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So,
yeah, it's Saving Private Ryan. I mean, content warning. I mean, it's such a rough movie, but it's such an important movie and a beautiful movie. It really mm-hmm. is the Greatest Generation for a reason.
Yeah. All right. I think we're on to our number 1s. Schweitzer, yep. What do you got?
Yeah, this is where I have Back to the Future.
All right. There you go.
It's like okay. My 26th favorite movie of all time or something like that. It's a classic and has some of the most memorable movie moments with some of the best, most memorable movie characters. It's really, again, really hard to find a bad thing to say about the movie other than it sometimes gets icky. It, I don't know, it handles it better than a movie from 1985 should.
That's fair. I think that's fair. Yeah. Yeah. No, I love Back to the Future.
It's been forever since I've seen it.
Yeah. I had it at number four. So obviously I agree with you. I think it's a really fun movie. I think the sequels are better than people usually give them credit for, but they're not as good as the original. I think the original is just a really, listen, I don't even know how much of it is Michael J. Fox is just so charismatic and fun to watch on screen. Like, I just, watch that guy in anything, and then just something that's sci-fi and fun like this, and has Christopher Lloyd just being amazing, I love Back to the Future.
Can you think of any other movie where the character is so obtusely portrayed as a loser that growing up you wanted to be? I want to be that loser. He's so cool.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World, maybe? I don't know.
Oh, well played. Well played. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of lovable losers in movie history, but no, you're right. Marty McFly is kind of the definition.
The coolest loser of all.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to figure out how old was Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future?
It's like somebody said, he can be anywhere between 45 and 90.
Yeah,
and
nobody
would be able to tell.
John Mulaney had that one in one of his stand-up specials where he's
essentially reaching
back
to
the future, and there's like, he's hanging out with this disgraced nuclear physicist. And how old is this guy? He's like somewhere between 40 and 80. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Who knows?
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
All right, you mentioned, I forget what it was that, Andrew, you said was the definition of a mistaken identity. Lebowski was like the most. I think my number one is probably on the same level as just like the entire plot is about mistaken identity, and that's North by Northwest.
We probably have the same number one.
Oh, maybe, I don't know. Mine's North by Northwest at number one.
No, we don't.
I've spoken many
times. I knew this was going to be, I should have known this was your number one.
Yeah. I mean, it's, what is it? Currently number five in my top movies of all time. My favorite Hitchcock movie. Just incredible, incredible stuff. Just such a compelling journey with this mistaken identity and, what happens. Hitchcock loved the normal man in extreme situations. He just loved that stuff. And one of the easiest ways to get there is mistaken identity. And so that's what he used here. And Cary Grant's incredible. So many incredible scenes in this movie. If you haven't checked it out, high, high recommend. North by Northwest is my number one. Andrew, what do you got at number one?
So it's a shame because this is one of those movies where it's a spoiler to say it's a mistaken identity movie. Hmm. And no matter how old this movie gets, it's one of those movies where I really hate spoiling it, but here it goes. Fight Club.
Well, I thought about Fight Club. I didn't consider this a mistaken identity movie, but I know
it's
what
a
you're saying.
Mistaken identity on yourself.
I know what, I know what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. And I don't begrudge you, for including it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's Fight Club. If you haven't seen it, sorry that I spoiled it for you. It's one of those few movies where, like, if somebody says, like, oh, I haven't seen it, I'm like, just stop everything you're doing in the world right now in case somebody is about to spoil it for you. Go and watch it. It's not the movie you think it's going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, a lot of people, even me, going into this movie, thought, oh, this is just going to be a crazy, machismo testosterone induced fight fest, and there are those moments of this movie, but you also gotta remember it's a David Fincher movie, and David Fincher will always find a way to put something on the next mm-hmm. level, and I think that this is it's his best movie for me.
Interesting. If I had considered it as mistaken identity, and again, I think you're absolutely right, I don't disagree with the idea you're going with, it would definitely have been in my top five as well. It's incredible filmmaking. It really is. All right. So honorable mentions. There's certainly a few we could talk about. I'll just rattle some off, and then if you guys have any others, you can mention them. School of Rock, I think, is worth mentioning. Talented.
Isn't that Deception?
No, I think it starts with Mistaken Identity, right? And then becomes Deception. So
I think
it's been a hot minute since I've seen it. So.
Yeah. Talented Mr. Ripley also starts with Mistaken Identity and becomes Deception. Great Dictator is worth mentioning. One of my favorites almost made my list over game night, Dave. Not a lot of people talk about Dave, but I love that one. Bug's Life. There's some Mistaken Identity of the Circus bugs, so I wanted to mention that. Dumb and Dumber has some Mistaken Identity in there, so that's worth mentioning. And then So I Married an Axe Murderer, another one of my underrated favorites, has some Mistaken Identity in it. What are some other ones maybe I didn't mention that you guys had in your honorable mentions?
Actually, I'm just looking at the chat right now. Jay Bourgeois has thrown out the Prestige. Would you consider the Prestige?
No, that's not Mistaken Identity. I think that is
Deception.
That's Deception. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we said that at the top of the segment that that Deception movies don't count in the Mistaken Identity.
Right. It has to be where somebody the idea is somebody mistakes a character or characters for something or someone they are not. And then that generates plot. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only one I'll throw out, and it's the only reason it's not in my top five is because it's not super relevant, but super bad, because there's that scene where Michael Cera gets mistaken for somebody's cousin as the singer.
Oh, God, and he has to sing, what does he sing? I love that scene.
These eyes I've seen.
Yeah, just the key changes just keep piling on top of each other. Yeah.
So it's not plot relevant, but has a scene.
There you go.
I love it.
Best ever Mistaken Identity movies. Feel free to let us know yours. All right, guys, let's get into the buried treasure. What's that one thing in any area of pop culture you want to make sure people know about it? Schweitzer, you're our guest, so you will go last. Andrew, you're doing the years of your life thing, catch up, list of shame.
That's right, Aaron. We're going all the way back to the year 1987. President Reagan tells Gorbachev to tear down a wall. Baby Jessica reports back that there is nothing at the bottom of her aunt's well. The Simpsons' first season premiered, I Turned One, and a little ditty of a movie was released. And that ditty was Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
Very nice.
A movie that I, unfortunately, have missed until this point. I said earlier on we are going to be talking about the Coen brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are again. Wow, this is a fun movie. I mean, I don't know what I was expecting going in. I really had no frame of reference other than my love of the Coen brothers. But as far as like plot or anything like that, I knew basically this was a Nick Cage movie, and it's what a lot of people consider to be Nick Cage's best performance and movie. I love his performance in this movie. I'm still going to go with Adaptation from what I think is his best performance, but what a crazy, fun, happy ride. For as dark material matter as what this is, the characters are so lovable. High is just such a I don't know if it's just the Southern drawl or his optimistic mannerisms, but you just fall in love with the guy. There is halfway through the movie, there is a chase sequence, like a cop, you know, chase sequence that is this close to being not Benny, what is it? Benny Hill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this close to being a Benny Hill bit, but there's enough of, I guess it's just not reeled fast enough is really what it is.
Yeah.
But I love John Goodman. I thought the idealist or the, I don't fully understand the concept of this, this hellbent Avenger character. Maybe if I watch this movie a couple more times, which I plan on doing because I had so much fun with it, I'll get more of an idea. At first, I thought he was going to be this, like a phantasmal, you know, entity. It's just like he is guilt, like he is guilt incarnate, you know. But then he turns out to be an actual character like a real physical being. And so I'm going to have to go back and rewatch this movie a couple more times to see if I fully understand everything about him. But the way everybody falls in love with that little baby from Nick Cage to John Goodman character, and how they all just see him. And I'm like, man, this baby, if he would have been able to remember, what a story he would have had to tell. What a great movie. And I'm so glad that I watched it. I really am. I should have watched it a long time ago.
It's a good one. Lots and lots of fun. And it's been a hot minute since I've seen it. I should probably do a rewatch. But I remember really, really enjoying it. I had already fallen in love with the Coen brothers by that point, and so I went back and watched it specifically because it was them, and was not disappointed. So, yeah, definitely.
Also, last week I didn't do my little What Happened in 1986 thingy. So, Chernobyl, what was the spaceship explorer?
The Challenger. No, was it
Challenger, you know.
Great year. And, great year. Chernobyl.
And I was born.
Space Challenger.
Oh, I'm going to let you know right now. I have one of those little intros for all the way from 1986 to 2020.
Nice.
And I'm going to let you know right now. Once you get into the later half of that segment or that chronological listing, not all of them are going to be funny.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Some of them are going to be pretty dark. Not going to lie.
I, for my buried treasure, want to talk about Star Wars Visions on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
They released
what your thoughts are.
9 episodes. They are basically short films set in the Star Wars. Well, I don't want to say set in the Star Wars universe because they technically are not canon. So they are
it's the what if of Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, except what if is technically MCU canon because of the multiverse. But they basically went to some really top-notch animation studios, and said, hey, play with the Star Wars stuff, give us a fun thing, and they did. Some of them I loved, like thought were really great. Some of them were good. All of them were watchable. So I don't think there's one in the batch of 9 that I would go, just skip it. It's not worth it.
So you've seen them all?
I have. I watched all 9 of them. Okay. And, you know, it's a fairly quick watch. I mean, it's basically like watching
like
a movie.
15 minutes.
Yeah. So you're dealing with watching, you know, like a 2-hour movie or 90-minute movie, basically to get through them. Some of them are more like 20 minutes. They're kind of all in that 12 to 25-minute range. But there's some good stuff there. And, you know, George Lucas famously pulled from, a lot of that culture for the samurai culture, that kind of stuff, for what he did with Star Wars. You know, the lightsabers are very katana-like. There's a lot of that in there. So to be able to kind of go back to the source and say, you know, now play with these elements in the place that they come from. I just, you know, I found it really interesting and really good. Star Wars Visions is what it's called. And it sounds like there'll be multiple seasons of this. I imagine much like What If, that as standalone anthology as the episodes appear to be, I would not be surprised if they revisit them and if there's more to tell, because some of them build a pretty interesting world that you want to go back to. There you go.
I've only seen the first 3, so I should say that. But that first episode that it kicks off with is
the duel.
So good.
Yeah.
It's so good. Is that your favorite, or is there one down the way that you'd be like?
I think... Oh, there's one. What's it called? The Wedding or The Bride, or I can't remember. But it takes place at a wedding. It's really incredible world building. So I want to see more from that one. I also want to see. There's one that deals with Kyber. Well, a lot of them deal with Kyber crystals and the idea of lightsabers and that kind of stuff. In fact, these one thing when you binge these, there is a lot of samey. I think every episode somebody says, I have a bad feeling about this. Like, it's just like...
Well, I think you have to. I think by this point, you know, it's not technically Star Wars.
Unless somebody does.
Somebody doesn't say, I had a bad feeling about this.
But I even just mean, like, plot-wise, there's a lot of Kyber crystal plots, a lot of, that kind of stuff. Yes, the chat has helped out. The Village Bride, I think, was my favorite.
Okay.
But there were also a couple others. There's one that deals with the idea of kyber crystals being able to immediately adapt to the force user holding them. And so, you know, a lightsaber would change colors from, you know, one force user to another based on their energy, that I found really interesting and a cool way to play with the storytelling. So I really like that one too. But some really interesting stuff here in Star Wars Vision. So I wanted to get that out there and recommend that. Nice. Schweitzer, what do you got?
This was really hard for me to narrow just one thing that I wanted to talk about, but I decided to go with a 2021 movie that was not covered on Civ Pop Weekly. It's my favorite film of 2021, Coda, on Apple TV Plus.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's Apple TV Plus movie original, so you could check it out there. It's it stands for Child of Deaf Adults, and it's about this child of deaf adults who grows up in like the South somewhere, like it's New England.
It's the South.
A Fisher family. She's part of a fisherman's family, and she has to like be a lot of what the family relies on, since she can speak and hear everything. So she's a normal speaking and hearing person, child of deaf adults, and discovers she has a passion for singing in high school and that she's really good at it. And so seeing the family dynamic shift there, it uses music in a really interesting way. And it has what is currently my favorite scene of the year, which is where there's like a technical way that they do this big performance that this movie has been building to. And instead of showing us the performance, they show us the parents reacting to the audience completely silent. And it's just one of the most beautiful moments. It's got makes me cry three times. I've seen it twice, two or three times now. I love this movie.
Yeah, I watched it recently and also really, really enjoyed it. It's a bit saccharine at times for me. Like, it's a bit over the top, but it works. It definitely works. And I have never had a completely deaf person in my life in close proximity. And so, you know, the empathy, I mean, that's what movies are for, you know, in many ways, is to be able to experience that kind of empathy in other people's worlds. I will say, I know this wasn't your intention at all, but I do want to mention it. I think you said something about normal hearing and speaking person, and normal is not the word that you know necessarily want
to
use there.
I tried to avoid saying that, but I'm sure it slipped, so apologies.
Yeah, but did want to mention that and just say Coda is a good one, and yeah, you can check that out again on Apple TV Plus.
Yeah, so, and they actually cast real deaf people, like Marley Matlin is like, I think, possibly the most famous deaf actress ever, and she won an Oscar. And then you also have Troy Kotsur? I know I'm butchering his name, but actually casting deaf people, for representation, and they're just great.
Yeah,
great
yeah.
actors and actresses yeah. too.
So. Lots of great performances. Well, there you go. We did it, guys. We did a podcast. We set out to do it, and it has been done. So congratulations to all who participated.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Civ Pop is part of the Studio DNA Podcast Network. So you can find out more about other shows on the network at studiodna.media or by searching Studio DNA in your podcast player. Huge thanks to Andrew for hanging out again today.
Thank you, buddy.
Big thanks to Phil for producing the audio and video show.
Thanks, Phil.
Excuse me. Got a little something caught in my throat. Thank you to Drew for providing visuals for the show.
Yeah, buddy.
And thank you to Aaron Schweitzer for coming and hanging out with us today. What do you want to promote? Aaron, what do you want to tell people about?
Yeah, really just want to direct people to the Writer's Room, Civ Pop Writer's Room, and wherever you're listening to podcasts. Just all the writers for the site come on in a kind of rotational basis. It's a good kind of overview for talking lots of different movies, usually older stuff, and getting to hear lots of different perspectives on that. So
that's the Civ Pop Writer's Room. should pop up if you search for SIFPOP. Should pop up if you search for Studio DNA. Should pop up if you search for Writer's Room. So lots of ways to get there on whatever podcast player you are using. Thank you to our SIFPOP members for giving monthly to make SIFPOP a real thing. Support starts at $3 a month. At the different levels, there are different bonuses, so you'll want to check those out at the site. Patreon.com/SIFPOP. Thank you for even going there. A lot of ways to connect with us. You can leave a comment, a rating, or a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Or you can send us an email, feedback@SIFPOP.com. And finally, if you're having a good time, your movie-loving friends will probably like the show too. So make sure you let them know about it and that listening is much easier than pulling off being a high schooler age 28. we will be back next week with Venom and Many Saints of Newark. So we will see you then.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.